Welcome to the Everything With Val podcast, hosted by me, Valerie DePaul. Today I'm doing another book for the Everything With Val book club. I am thankfully not doing this one alone, but I'm joined by Maddie and Beth from the Off The Book podcast. Today we are going to discuss the book Circe by Madeline Miller. And please, I'm just going to say this now, please do not proceed listening to this episode of the podcast. There will be a ton of spoilers. So if you want to read Circe first, go ahead, pause here, read it, and then continue the episode. So you have been warned that there will be spoilers. So once again, welcome to the show. I would like to welcome both Maddie and Beth. So please take some time, introduce yourself and your podcast.
Hello.
Hi. Thank you for having us on. This is like really exciting for us. I'm Maddie.
Thank you for joining.
I'm Beth, and well, Maddie's introduced herself, and we are from Off the Book, the podcast. Yay.
We basically just talk all like just about books. That's literally it.
Like little tagline is that we talk all things YA, NA, adult books. As of yet, we've not covered adult books. I don't know if we can class this. This is the most grown-up book I think we've ever done.
Most grown up, I love it. But you're joining me remotely as well from the UK, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes.
Great. Could have been like one of you were in Greece, you know, staying very on theme for this week's book.
Oh, I wish.
Me too, I wish as well. But I think obviously to just get into it, just talk a little bit about your podcast. How did you decide to start it? What made you want to do a podcast all about reading? And are you guys tired of reading yet or not yet?
I'm going to hop in before Maddie can answer because this is one of my favorite stories to kind of like tell. Maddie and I met at university. We were friends for a year. Then we hated each other's guts, like absolutely couldn't stand each other. And we then had to live with each other in third year. And we were kind of like rebuilding our friendship. But I'd say like one of the things that really fully brought us back was that we both were reading different book series, however the word goes, book series, but by the same author. And so we kind of started to text each other like every single night, freaking out about all these book things. And we'd kind of just sit and read together. And it was great. And eventually Maddie just texted me and was like, should we just start a podcast? Because we love talking about books and we talk about it with each other. There might be other people out there that agree with us, might actually want to hear the most random stuff that we'll say. So, and we kind of started about a year ago this month, and we haven't looked back. And now we've basically morphed into the same person. And I text Maddie literally all the time. We are inseparable.
Yeah. So I get really bad migraines, and like podcasts are what I listen to when I have a migraine because I can't sleep, but I can't do anything else except lay in a dark room. And I was trying to, I'd gone through all of the podcasts I normally listen to, and then I was like, I'll just see if there's any book reviews on there. Could not find any. And I would message Beth and I was like, here's what we're doing. You don't really have a say in the matter. We're just starting it. But it's mad that it's been a year. It doesn't feel like it.
Happy anniversary.
On that note, that's how I find you, because I did the most, you know, on-trend thing. I went in your DMs and reached out to you to do a collaboration as well, because that's exactly how I found you, because I watched Shadow and Bone, and then I looked for a podcast that talked about the Six of Crows, because I've read Six of Crows and Crooked Kingdom, and I couldn't find a single good, well done podcast about it until I found yours, and then I listened to that one, and it was super awesome, so I really liked that one. And I think like what you guys are doing is really fun because you obviously bring your own personalities, but you also give like an in-depth like intro into those books as well. Because I feel like, yes, you talk a little bit about the spoilers, but I could easily listen to one of your episodes and still read the book as well, which is awesome. I don't know if you'll agree, but I think so.
Thank you. I think well done is giving it too much credit. We literally just turn on a microphone and hope for the best.
I think the way we record is, the thing is, we'll turn the microphone on and we'll just discuss the book. I think it comes quite naturally because we just mess around. Like, we're just recording a conversation between us two, whether someone hears it or not. Like, we make notes of the plot and stuff, but I think we kind of want it to have the feel of like we're just two friends talking about books. We want people to feel like they're there for that conversation. So yeah, it's a very chilled vibe.
Nice. So then for today's book, obviously, the book Circe, the book is set in the Greek heroic age, and it has a lot of characters that I'm sure some of us have learned about in school or have heard about if you've ever studied Greek mythology or have ever been interested in it. It was written in 2018, And it's from the same author who famously wrote Song of Achilles, if some of you have read that one as well or listened to it. I listened to it. But to just get started with the book sort of overview, and we'll dive deeper later on in the episode with the actual critique of what we think. But what did we think overall? Beth, Maddie, what did you think? What were your 5 stars? How much?
But I'm going to be honest. This book is not for me. I would give it a 2.5 stars, but that's got nothing to say about the writing. The writing's beautiful, but I just, this type of book bores me so much. I really wanted to enjoy it. I really did, but it's just, it's like an autobiography, and there's like tiny little plots within it, but like there's no overarching plot, and it was just, So yeah, 2.5.
I would agree. Yeah. I would agree. I gave it 3, 3.5, because I didn't actually think that it was a book. I think it was like a book of tales, because it's sort of split into like 5 different adventures or things about her. And wow, fuck, it's a slow burn. Sorry for swearing, but it is a slow burn.
I feel exactly the same. I'm glad so I'm not the only one.
See, I kind of liked it. I'd give it like a 3.5, maybe a 4. I definitely agree. It feels like a series of just kind of short stories throughout Cersei's life. But I could kind of see the overarching plot of it. I quite liked it. It took me a long time to get in. It is definitely a slow burn, and it was a lot slower than I would have liked. But I think I'm starting to realize I do quite like Greek mythology retellings. And it was a weird book. Or for me, that was a weird book to realise that with, because it wasn't the best Greek retelling that I've read, but I liked it. And I liked some of the really kind of like feminist vibes that Cersei gave off from just certain points.
Yeah, I think so as well, because when I was reading it, like, it takes you a while to get into, and then the points where you do really get into it, now Maddie may completely disagree, but I think like when you do actually get into it, some of them can be really exciting. And then at others, you're like slowly crying baby nuggets of like, can you just get to the point, please, eventually?
Yeah, no, I think I definitely agree. But then again, it's not the worst Greek mythology that we've read. We've read some modern retellings, and I'll leave them nameless, but we've on our podcast read some modern retellings of Greek mythology, and they've just been straight up interesting. But I think preferred this.
I'm really sorry to tell you this, but I gave that book more stars than I gave this book.
But that book that we're not going to talk about is literally a questionable love story, and I'm still angry.
I still think it's better than this book. We're talking about the common thread of darkness, just for the record. Yeah.
Which is like a modern day, it's like a Wattpad retelling Hades and Persephone, who are uncle and niece. But there was the twist of incest at the ending of, or slight incest, I think, at the ending of this one.
If you have to say it's technically not incest. Is it incest, though?
Well, that's the thing I was wondering. I'm not sure. It kind of gave off that vibe slightly.
It is weird. If you have to say technically, but I mean, then there's something not right about it anyway, isn't there?
But to go straight into that, because now we're talking about it as well, and we just mentioned a little bit, to talk about the characters. Like, if we discuss the characters, who did we love and who did we not so much love? Who was, like, a fan favorite for you, or who were you like, nope, please just don't come back again?
I mean, personally, I really liked, obviously, Cersei, because we're in her mind and we see her kind of justification of all of her actions. I thought she was quite cool, especially when she gets revenge on the people that anger her, especially that middle part of the book when she's on the island, I liked. I also kind of, he was a bit of a, pardon my language, he was a bit of a dick, but I did kind of like Hermes, but just the way that he interacted early on with Cersei. And then, I don't know how to say his name, Deidalus, the sculptor, I think he was quite nice.
I really liked him as well. I thought he was, you know, he was trying to add more to the world than he was taking out. You could see that he had like a lot of good intention, and I don't know, I really liked his character. I thought he was really nice, and I thought, you know, he did a lot for his family, even when he was, I mean, her sister, how do you pronounce her name? Pasiphae?
I said it, Pasiphae.
Yeah, Pasiphae. Because she has 2 twin siblings, Pasiphae and Percy, and Pasiphae sort of chooses his wife. And what I thought was so like kind of weird is that he still tried to make it work. Always. He always tried to make things well. And it was his like son and him's goal to like go to Egypt. And even when that didn't go well, he still kept trying. So I really liked his ambition and sort of his resilience at some parts, I think.
Yeah, I'd say that for sure. I also kind of, the part where I was starting to freak out and be like, oh, I know that bit of Greek mythology is when they mentioned that his son is Icarus. And I was like, oh, I know that name.
Which was I quite agree. Cool. I really like the character.
I would agree as well. But
other than that, I'm going to be honest.
Wait, which one? Sorry, I didn't hear what you said.
Oh, Daedalus? Is that how you say it?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but other than that, I'm not going to lie. I found them all kind of really dull.
Yeah, I can't argue that one either. Because, for example, her dad, I found him so dry. I was like, why did you have kids if you were not going to partake in their lives? If you weren't going to actually do anything and just be an asshole? I'm sorry, but why did you have children? You didn't get anything out of any... Like, it's not that then when they had kids, he was like, now you are... you know, this, and you will go on to do these things. He literally sat on his ass, drank, went away, feared Zeus, and did nothing, and complained. He complained a lot.
Literally, he feared Zeus, but also at the same time was willing to, like, make minor, he was, like, kind of treacherous towards him, but wasn't willing to actually do anything in all, like, I'm not wording this very well. He basically does nothing the entire book until like the very end. And even then, he's only doing it because Cersei's like, oh, you need to do this. Like, he's so dry.
So dry. But what did you think, Beth? Let's see your take. Maybe you were like, I could see where he was going with it.
The only way I would describe him does include swear words, and I don't know if I'm allowed to swear on the podcast. He was not the nicest man.
Please.
Oh, great. I thought he was an asshole. He really wasn't very nice. It's that thing of like, and the favoritism that he had with the kids. Like, the thing is, like, he did nothing to help raise them. Like, he'd tell like a random, boring prophecy that made no sense. And then he just kind of would go and drink. He didn't really care for anyone except himself. And I actually found him quite angering because of the way he treated Cersei. I mean, it's just the fact that she was born and like literally no one cared. Like him most of all. And it just, yeah, I didn't like him. He was not a nice man. And I don't think he has any redeeming qualities whatsoever. So not a fan of him. Absolutely not. I didn't really like her mum either, because she kind of gave off the similar vibes to the dad, but also was very, how would I describe her? She felt very, there are points in the plot where she finds things out about her kids and she starts to brag about how amazing she is. But it's that thing of like, really? I didn't really like the parents at all. I don't know if anyone else agreed.
I'm just pausing because Maddie is offline, so I'm wondering if she is trying to log on.
Yep, cool.
I have a comment to say to you back, but I'm just waiting 1 second.
Okay.
All right, so speaking of unstable or shitty parenting, we've now heard about the dad, which I think we can all agree was just quite useless, but at least he did something, you know, godly in a sense. But her mom, let me just start here. One, she complained. Two, she did nothing but sit with her aunts or like the people and servants in the hall and complain that she didn't do anything, or like her children didn't bear her anything. She didn't go out and do something for herself. She was waiting for her children to like sort of do something and be like, you are the mother of this who accomplished that. What do you think? I think she was just also so useless in a way.
She was just a waste of space, really, wasn't she?
Yeah. I just found her really annoying because she very much, she would wait, like she'd have the children and then she'd wait to see if they had like a really cool prophecy. And if not, she just kind of like left them be. And it's the point when like Cersei's born, nobody cared. And it's awful. And then they had the next child who's like 80s, I think. And like, they also didn't care about him. And you just think like, come on. And like, it then really annoyed me then later on in the book when she finds out like that actually those kids are kind of useful. Then she's bragging about how she's the mother of these really cool kids. And it's just that thing of like, you've not done anything though. Like at this point for Cersei, like you're her mum in like blood, but like you've not done anything like motherly. Like you're, it just really annoyed me the way she's really kind of claiming their glory for herself when she's done absolutely nothing to be part of it. It just wound me up.
Yeah. It kind of, like, she's just a really shitty parent, isn't she? Like, like there's no way to, no two ways to say it. Like, I also am curious to know what made the twins so special that they got this attention from her. Like, was it just, like, that they had more, like, godly powers? Is that what it is?
But then if you think about that, though, yeah, like, because Cersei was firstborn, and they, because, were the twins first or was Cersei first?
Cersei was first.
Oh.
I'm sure
yeah,
she
Cersei was.
Yeah,
Cersei was first. Yeah, I'm pretty sure she was. So Cersei was first, let's just say that. And then when the twins came, if you think about it, neither of them did really anything with their powers, because she, we're going to go into this later into like the entire plot, but she had sex with a bull and then gave birth to a mini monitor. And then after all of that, and then having a fight with her husband, she then went back to the Great Halls and continued to live off of her dad's fame, or like their family fame. And the brother went and lived off of the younger brother, and just collectively try to figure out how can we be terrible people in the world, right? Or am I wrong?
No, that's right, yeah.
You're definitely right. I think the only person that actually tried to do something good was Cersei, because...
Literally.
Well, she gets revenge on the people who are terrible, or is terrible towards her. So I think she's the only one that did something right. Not that I'm necessarily saying that getting revenge in the ways that she does is a good thing, but like it's... Out of all the characters in the book, I think she's one of the kind of best in that regard.
Yeah, I would agree. And then if we look at like other characters besides like the main family, I think one of my favorites genuinely was Telonicus, which is the son of Penelope and Odysseus. I really liked him because I felt like he was a way ahead of his time. He didn't need fame. He didn't need extravagance. He was like, I want to live a simple but happy and good life with a person. And that is what I want
agree.
In my life.
I normally highlight books. I know, tragic. Everyone hates it. But like the only part I really highlighted was one of his like monologues with Cersei, and I really enjoyed it. It was just like down to earth, and like he was just like the way he spoke about life. I was like, yes. It's chill, it's fine. Like, you seem like a normal person, whereas everybody else in this book is just trying to do the worst thing possible, except for Cersei, like just trying to do the worst thing possible.
Also, all with self-interest, right? Because he also had so much wisdom, like about friendship and about, you know, being around others to share things with, whether it's good, whether it's bad. And I think he had been through so much, and I think they both collectively, like from a mortal perspective, and then obviously she as a god or like immortal, they both did so much things that weren't for themselves, but for the fact that they thought it would get them more love from the people around them. Because if you think about it, both of them just simply wanted to be loved. Her by her dad, by like the people she slept with or were dating, even her son, all she ever wanted was love.
Well, that 100%. Just broke my heart. Oh, I hadn't even thought of it that way. Jeez. Oh, I'm going to be in my feels about that for the next, like, 20 minutes. Jeez.
But I think that's what was so devastating, is that they both, like, so, again, Telonicus, who is the son of Penelope and Odysseus. Odysseus was this guy that came to her island and seeked refuge. And she had such terrible experiences in the past that I'm sure maybe we'll speak about later. But when he came, I think they both sort of connected so quickly based on the fact that they had done some unspeakable things for the like people in their life. For example, like he hung the servants and he killed all of those people who were suitors who came for his mother and everything. He didn't really want to do any of those things. He didn't want them, you know, attacking his mom or anything. But he didn't really want to harm anyone. But he did want the love of his dad. but just in a different way than what his dad could offer him. Like, his emotional needs and intimacy levels was on a way different wavelength than what theirs were.
And I think Odysseus was quite an interesting character because he, the version we see of him, like, drastically changes from, like, the time period we spend with him to, like, the time period after. Like, I found that really baffling to see the massive change. And, like, how, especially his relationship to his son, what we hear before we meet I was about to call him Teletubby, but that's definitely not his name. But, like, his son beforehand, like, it's that thing of, like, he's always saying, oh, I cannot wait to get back to my son, da-da-da, very loving and very gentle. And then, like, afterwards, after the fact, he's a completely different person. And... yeah, it's just interesting.
Shocked, like, that the change of personality, because we see, like, little glimpses of it whilst he's on the island with Cersei. Like, he gets angry for literally no reason and is, like, really aggressive towards people and things. So I think it was there all along. It's just, like, something along the way just made the rest of that personality come out. Does that make sense?
That makes sense.
Yeah, I would agree. And then, since we're now diving deep into it, I hope with the help of both of you, let's sort of discuss the plot and then dive deeper into certain areas that we liked. I think, obviously, when we start the book, Cersei, we're introduced to her character because she does narrate it, right? If I'm being correct.
She's the narrator.
Yeah, it's from the first person, yeah. And we're introduced to Cersei, who is the daughter of Helios, who is a Greek god, who way back when obviously had some friction with Zeus. And we come to learn, you know, her mother is bearing children for Helios, and she has these two siblings called Pasiphae and Perse, who were, you know, these very beautiful children, golden, and they had these godlike voices. I could actually never understand throughout the book because they mention it a couple of times. She has a voice that is most similar to mortals, so like our voices, and they had one, you know, that was more like really captivating and sort of lyric-like. I think it's more like a singing tone. If I don't know if you guys agree, but that's just how I sort of pictured it, which was very melodic and things like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's what did you think how
the
well.
Opening was?
Sorry, what was that?
No, I just, I cut you off there a little bit when I was finishing, but I just said, you know, with their voices and everything, because they always gave her shit for how she sounded, because it sounded mortal-like and scratch throat. That's why she, in the beginning, we found out that she just stopped talking because she couldn't really handle the grief she was getting. So I just thought, what did you think? Because when I pictured, I just think that their voices are much more melodic, as if they were singing or something.
Yeah, and then Hermes also says that it's just a lot quieter than the gods' voice. So the gods are just like, they're like bellowing effectively. Like, that's why the mortals are always so scared of them, because they come across as really intimidating. That's how I read it anyway.
I think it was also quite interesting that he points out that, like, obviously her voice is quieter. It would kind of suggest that if her voice is quieter, she also seems less powerful, because she doesn't have this godly voice. She has a human voice, and it obviously kind of feeds into that. She's not as powerful as the other gods and goddesses. And, oh, I had another point and it's just left my head. Oh, actually, it's made out to be one of her weaknesses, but I think as the book goes on, it actually comes out to be one of her strengths, the fact that she doesn't have a godly voice. And I think that was quite interesting.
Yeah, I would agree, because during that time, what we can see then from her is that she sort of goes inward, right? She figures things out on her own. She only really tries to get the love and attention of her father, because when they have, you know, the great dining scenes, like when they're eating or feasting, she sits by his feet and her uncles and tries to listen to everything. And I think she's one of those people that actively listens to really get everything around her. And when she has those siblings, she really becomes, you know, self-reliant. She has to entertain herself because she doesn't really have any friends, and those other people around her just continuously make fun of her until she has, you know, her small brother named Aeetes, supposedly, you know, who will one day go on to do great things in other people's minds. But I remember when he was born, it wasn't really an exciting thing. He was just a baby that she held for like the first 2 years of his life or something.
Yeah, that's like one of the points where the mum comes out to be so shitty, because she literally has this child. Dad doesn't even bother giving him a prophecy at that time. And then, like, I think she like hands the baby off to like the aunties and is like, oh, find somewhere for him to go. And Cersei's like, oh, no, let me have him. And actually, in my mind, the overarching kind of theme of this book is that just don't rely on men, because for the first few years of this baby's life, Cersei kind of loves him, nurtures him, like is entire, basically is the like the motherly figure. And then the first chance he gets to run away, he does. And like we see that as a kind of continual theme with all the male characters. And I think that's quite heartbreaking, and especially for the younger brother who's really grown to look after. It was just annoying.
The moment where he gets like his island or his kingdom or whatever it is, and then Cersei's like, oh, I'll come with you, and he says no, I felt like my heart broke for her. Like, all she's ever done is like love and care for him, and the second that he gets the opportunity to go away and leave her, he does. Like, it's like so out of order for no reason.
I would agree. It only reminded me of that one quote. I don't know if you guys have seen that movie, The Imitation Game, where it's like this famous guy who figured out the codes during World War II from the Germans. And he says, sometimes it's the people no one imagines anything of who do the things no one can imagine. So when I was reading that, that's what I imagined of Cersei, you know, everyone doubting her, everyone expecting nothing. And then she does. She goes and does things that no one could have imagined of her.
I mean, that quote, I think, perfectly sums her up. And I was going to say, yeah, that I've not seen The Imitation Game, but that's about Alan Turing, who's an absolute legend. And I think they've actually just put him on the like British money. I think they've started putting him on the back of like £5 notes. But I might be wrong there. Maddie might be able to correct me there.
Beth, do you think I know? Do you seriously think I know the answer to that?
Maddie, you are smarter than me, so yes, I was hoping you would.
I do not even know the name of the person that you just said. I don't know him, but you know I suck at names.
Okay. No, well, fine. If I'm going off, I'm pretty certain they've decided to put him on the back of like British money now because he was so influential in winning the war, but he had such a horrendous time because he was a genius. But society wouldn't accept him because of who he loved. And it was a very heartbreaking story in its own right.
Yeah, it really was. And then they sentenced him to like conversion therapy and such. And he agreed to it just so that he could stay and keep working, because that was his whole life. All he wanted to do was figure out these things and add a lot of value to people's lives as well. It was super torturous. But we divert back to Cersei a little bit, but I think what I found surprising, obviously after her brother was born, she tells him about the fact that, right? I think that's his name. He was
Prometheus,
yeah. So he actually sort of, he disobeyed Zeus to help mortals, giving them fire and in some stories teaching them the arts of civilization as well. So Zeus punished him. And he was sent to the halls of Helios for a little time. So he was like shackled and everything like that. And when everyone leaves after he's been tortured over and over again, she brings him some like aid and everything, like juice and some apricots and such. And just talks to him and says, you know, why did you do these things? And eventually uses this against him. But I think what was so interesting is that, again, it's another point where you can feel that her character just wants to connect with someone. Like it's not that she's proud of the secret, but she's like, here's a little bit of me. What can you share about yourself with me as well in return with her brother?
I mean, after her brother betrayed her, to be honest, I'm just glad that he never told anyone that and shared that secret. Because, I mean, obviously he betrays her by leaving, and he kind of, whenever we see him again, he's just not really a very nice person. So I was very glad that he'd never kind of spilt that secret, because that is a really bad thing to have done. Because obviously they were, I think he was like whipped really brutally. Like I always find those kinds of scenes kind of upsetting in books, but obviously it's important to the plot. So I was reading through it, and it's like done by the Furies, and it's like this massive thing. My brain's just stopped working once again. I've forgotten exactly the point I was making.
No, but obviously, so they grow up together, and they get this one area of a beach for themselves, so they always hang out there, and then they, you know, really bond over everything. But I think it was more time passing for him, and for her it was everything. It was like, you know, this huge sibling bond that they always shared with each other, because he obviously leaves and goes on to do his own life, and then she starts seeing a mortal boy that keeps coming to her shore named Glagos, who she falls in love with and would like to turn him into an immortal, because he, obviously he's always tired. He's always having problems, especially with his dad, who I can assume maybe is a little bit abusive. And from there starts finding these plants and kind of figures out that she can manipulate plants and turn him into sort of this immortal being. And just assumes that it was, you know, the fate of the gods, I think.
My favorite part of that is that, so she fell like really in love with kind of like Glaukos, whatever his name is. And it's the point of like, she knows that she wants to make him immortal and she speaks to like her family and they're like, no, there's nothing we can do. And then she realizes, now I don't fully understand it, but it's something about like, if the blood of the gods has landed somewhere like on land, it can give like the land magical properties. I didn't really pay attention to that part. It was kind of confusing, but it's the fact that she realizes that she kind of like takes like control of her own kind of like bodily autonomy, and the fact that she then realizing that the only way to help Glaukos is to like actually socialize with like her family and all the people that have like been so cruel to her. And she kind of like controls herself, kind of gets very flirtatious, kind of like talks like to everyone in the court, and she finds out every single piece of information that she will find value in. And like, it's through that like kind of claiming herself and claiming her confidence. I just thought that was so great. And then obviously later on it kind of turns out her plan, well, they all kind of not knew what she was doing, but they knew what information they wanted her to know. But I think it was such a, and also that whole, I think, section was written, it was so clear that she was going to fall for this mortal man, like in the way that he was described. I think it was, to me it was really, really clear that he was like the love interest. But I've learned a long time ago to never trust the first love interest, because they never end up well.
Yeah, and then I think, you know, it's sort of the repetition. You're just hoping that she learns. It's sort of like, she does it once, okay, she gets hurt. She does it again, she gets hurt. Because after she helps him become, through these plants, an immortal, he sort of, you know, goes on his own rampage and makes it seem like he was the gift of, you know, he was the next strawberry or blueberry of the sort. So speaking in these halls about how he became who he came. And then he sees Scylla, this beautiful girl who's also in Cersei's sort of entourage group, and says to her, you know, what do you think of her? Wouldn't it be amazing if I married her? And completely rejects how much she's done for him. Completely forgets her. She's off the map. Now that he's someone of a name, that is of this privilege, he can get whoever she wants. And obviously I think it's a natural reaction for some people that she would turn and be like, okay, how can I get him back to focusing on me? What can I do to her that she's completely irrelevant for him?
Yeah,
I don't blame her for making the decision that she did. Like, she really did everything for him. Like, her main goal was to basically make him happy so that they could be together. And then he just like turns her back on her immediately the second he gets like a little bit of power. And it's just like, I understand why she's frustrated. I would say calling her Scylla, but I don't think that's right. Like, I understand why she's frustrated with her, but ultimately it's not her fault that Glaukos decides to ask her to marry her. So I don't hate Cersei for making that decision, but like, it was out of order for Scylla, even though Scylla was a bit of a bitch. But yeah.
Yeah, I think if you could have changed something, just because it's not really like her fault that he liked her. I mean, again, she wasn't exactly like the most intellectual or whatever from what we could tell in the book. But I just wish she rather had, because how the story progresses is that she turns her into the sea monster creature that then starts to eat sailors when they go in her route and all of these things. I wish she turned him into like some octopus, like, here, be useless. Like, if you're not going to add anything here.
I would have loved her to do that.
I think that I really like this bit because I think I've got the word here. This is the point where we start to learn that she's got, it's like a power called like Pharmaka. I don't really know how to pronounce it, but it's like this kind of, because she speaks to her grandmother about it, and her grandmother is very much like, don't you dare say that word. How dare you? I'm not really sure what it is, like what that word is, but it translates to like a certain kind of magic that's not really allowed. And it's the fact that she has no control over it. Well, I think what's the thing? It's meant to be like, the things that she does, like the flowers and stuff, it turns you into like the form of who you truly are. I would have really liked it, I agree, if they'd turned Glaukos into like an octopus, because in the end he was just useless and he was terrible. Like, I found it quite frustrating that he then got this kind of like god-like body and was turned into someone powerful, because he was actually at his core a really nasty person. So I was kind of angry that he got this kind of new better life.
I completely agree. It was like kind of unfair, because it seemed like everything worked out for him. Like, obviously I don't think his life was easy. I'm not taking away any pain and suffering he went through, but then he just sort of, he had the opportunity to be like, I got a better life, so hopefully everyone else did. He acted in spoil. He like sent that tide that killed his dad and sort of ended that section of him, and then just completely forgot who he was as a person, and then became this other being that was obviously accepted very well amongst the men, and just, yeah, didn't really do anything, like just became complacent in being this god. Because straight after that, we then have her brother Aetes return, who tells about doing all of this witchcraft, and then Cersei reveals that this is how she has made him as well. And then her dad decides to exile her. What did you guys think about that scene?
Isaac, just before we go on to that section, I'm so sorry. Yeah, I just remembered another point from that previous section. So after she turns Skilla, whatever, into this monster on accident, first of all, because like Cersei goes to her father and says, look at what I've done. I've done this with these flowers. I've turned him into a god. I've turned her into a shark monstery thing. And like, she's publicly like tortured for doing something, that for kind of confessing the treason. And I wasn't really sure whether she was being punished for doing that, or for like publicly showing that she's not just some kind of quiet, like mousy girl who can't do anything. And then it's the point where later on her father and Glaukos go out into the corridor, and she follows them because she's still so in love with Glaukos, and she's hoping that he's going to ask after her. And she hears them have the conversation of her dad is setting him up with any of the other sea nymphs, and they walk past her afterwards, and they know that she's overheard every single part of this conversation. And it's heartbreaking because she's there like, they know that I can hear them, they know that he, like at that point, like Glaukos is fully aware that she's in love, fully aware of everything she's done, and he does not appreciate it one bit. So then when she gets to, like, exiled, it's heartbreaking. But I think as well, I mean, not that we know what would have happened if she wasn't exiled, but I think actually being exiled was one of the best things for her, because she really kind of comes into herself and like learned from this awful experience.
I think the exile itself was just kind of more of a statement than anything. Like, she was alone in like her dad's halls. She's alone on the island. Like, everything, every want and need that she has is effectively just given to her by the island. Like, the exile itself seems really pointless to me. I understand that, like, she needed to be punished for, like, what she did, but it was more to make a statement than literally anything else. Like, and I think she says at one point that, like, even the Titans exiles live better than the Olympians, like, to make a statement that they're better than them in a way. Like, she's not effectively being punished in any way. I have no idea if that makes sense.
No, I see your point. Just thank you for bringing up this point that they happened before. I sort of missed that one. As I said before, a lot goes on in this book, so if I miss something, please just forgive us. But I think, as you were saying there, what's actually quite sad, I don't know if you've both noticed this, that throughout the novel, or the book, she's only sort of legitimized or validated by men. Because here we have a prime example. She made this revelation. She's like, this is what I've accomplished. This is what I've been able to do. And every other small thing that she's done. And then throughout the book, when she does all of these things, like, she's a goddess. She's made this island. She's turn, you know, flowers into bees. She has lions and everything. And she's only revered or feared because other men have confirmed and validated her as a goddess, that she has this voice, that this is her ability. And then when her brother comes in this example, then she's validated. Oh, I'm a witch. Yeah, I told you that. What do you mean?
I would definitely agree with that, the fact that it's validated, like, either she'll be celebrated or feared because of the things that men say, or even like her siblings, like passive fae, I think it is. Like, so, like anyone else, but specifically the men in High Life will validate her. But I do like, I think internally we do see her validating herself more and more. I think definitely by the middle section of the book, I think she is more kind of like, again, when she, I'm calling it revenge, I think that's the right term, like when she starts to take hold of her power and kind of like control people and get back on them, I think she definitely is fully aware of like, I have done this, this is something that I've created and I don't need anyone else to know. I can just be proud of myself that I've taken this upon, you know, I've taken this into my own hands.
For sure. And I think obviously when she takes it in herself, because we see a lot of her inward journey as well, but I really, like, that's something that really frustrated me when I was like, she's only validated when men validate what she does and no one else, not even when she takes ownership of her own things.
I'm an absolute sucker for, like, I always make a list of all my favorite quotes, and there's one, I think from, like, relatively into this section where it's actually, no, I think it's from a little bit later on in the book, not massively far, and she just says to her, or like in her internal monologue, like, I was not the same as I had been, I owed him nothing, he would have of me only what I wanted to give. And I think, I actually kind of think this is a really great book about like introducing boundaries specifically like for yourself and the way that people are around you. I think she starts to understand that people validate her and that feeds into this image of who she is, Cersei. Like later on when she becomes friends with Hermes, she is fully aware that what he says about her is what everyone knows, because no one visits her when she's on the island except like the odd person. And so she's fully aware that she can do whatever she wants. It doesn't matter, because Hermes will tell whatever stories he wants. And I think I found it quite empowering the fact she then goes, well, whatever I tell him, he'll kind of tell an element of that truth. So she's, I think she kind of takes the power into her own hands by telling him the story she wants people to know, if that makes sense. Did anyone else see it that way?
Yeah, 100%. I like that whole section where she was like, it is like Hermes' story of her, but in a way she's feeding him things to give the impression of what she wants. Like, it is twisted and it's not 100% fact, but she is taking some sort of power back for herself.
I also really love that, like, we really see her, because like her brother, when she asked him like, oh, well, like, how do these powers work? He was basically like, I can't tell you, you got to just figure it out. And so like when she gets into this exile, she, I think she really becomes one with nature, because she walks around and I think it's a point she realizes the island is quiet, and it's like when she was in the halls, yes, she was alone, but she was surrounded by people, whereas now she's alone completely and she actually enjoys it that way, because at least she's not being ignored, she's alone for a reason. And so she kind of really throws herself into nature. One of my favorite parts of this section is when she does realize she's lonely and wants company, she just magics herself up like a lioness that just becomes her best friend. If I had that power, I 100% would just magic up like a big cat to follow me everywhere. I like, that's really off topic, but I just thought that was the most badass thing ever.
Yeah, I think so as well, because what I found interesting was that when she was exiled to this island, right? I think it's quite funny how Helios still made it about him. Just want to bring it back, because he obviously gives her this deserted island where no one is, but she still has this grandiose house or sort of mini palace where she has, you know, rugs, gold, all of these things, because how on earth could an exiled daughter of Helios live like just on an abandoned island with nothing, the bare necessities? Just then she still had all of those, and I thought that was quite interesting. But yeah, as you were saying, like, she just conjures up all of these animals and sort of these partners for her life, because the one lion that she brings out from almost nothing stayed with her for how long was it, like 300 or something years?
Yeah, it was like 300 and some years, and then like eventually it like has its own cubs and stuff. And I just, yeah, I thought that was really cool. And like eventually wolves show up. So it's also, they're like, I also kind of like found that like, oh, I feel like I'm getting a little bit too analytical, but like the fact that she summoned up a lioness and she'd like done a spell and said like, I want a companion, like whatever, you know, whatever the universe has, I will accept. And the fact that a lioness kind of came in and was like a very strong symbol, or it's a symbol of strength, and also being a lioness, it's like female strength. But I think that's me just getting way too analytical into it.
This is your was it A level English literature coming out, Bethany.
Mm-hmm. You know it.
I also would say that it's quite interesting that once you have gotten on this island, she's lived there for a number of years, she gets this messenger sent, which was, as we now know, it was Daedalus, and he was sent through, you know, these very treacherous waters, which had Scholar, the sea monster beast, and he was sent there to go and get her for her sister, and she doesn't really know why, so she arrives at Crete, because her sister was married off to the future king of Crete, and they send for her, and she's been exempted from the exile. And obviously, if you don't really know the character of Daedalus, he was a master craftsman credited with several famous ancient inventions and also art, including, you know, a dancer circle used by Adrian and the great labyrinth which jailed the Minotaur, which we'll get into now. But I think just before that, we're also introduced to Hermes, which was her lover, kind of. I think they both used each other for like the sexual like pleasures of sorts, who hides something on her island and sort of recuperates for 3 days, because I thought it was so cheeky that he came just before and was like, someone is coming. And she's like, yeah, okay, you can leave now. Thanks so much for that great insight.
I see, this is where I say I really liked Hermes and her relationship very early on. And it's the part of, he's very flirty, and I think he knows the kind of power he can have over women because he's very flirty. He's very easygoing. Well, easygoing, I don't know if this is the right phrase, but we hear in her mind, she's the one, I think, that makes the first move, I think. I thought that was quite empowering. Like, she chooses to have Hermes be that kind of, like, first lover and have that kind of connection. And I think, I don't know if this is also the point where he tells, like, a prophecy and it's the most vague thing ever. And he's like, oh, and also someone's literally sailing to your island right now. Kind of forgot to mention it. Good luck. And it's that thing of, like, she's completely thrown into the deep end with one random bullshit prophecy. And then also, oh, by the way, you know, tidy up the house, your guests come in, and you're just like, what?
I just kind of love that he's here for the drama. Like, he's here to be entertained. Yeah. Like, she's fully aware of that. So she's like, really, like, she kind of just accepts that as what he is. Like, it's just who he is. He wants to be entertained. And the second that she becomes not entertaining anymore, he just like disappears. Like, he's not there anymore. But the fact he just drops in and he's like, by the way, there's a ship out there. They're just thought I'd let you know, and then disappears. Like, that's so funny to me.
It's also the fact that, like, when he shows up, it's because he's stolen like a lyre from Apollo being like one of the biggest gods like in existence, and he's just so chill, like, hey, you're already in trouble and exiled here, I feel like you could definitely hide this thing that I shouldn't have stolen, like, it's totally fine, you're already in trouble. And I think it's just that kind of, I just love him living, like, I live for the drama that he brings. I thought that was great.
I agree. And then I think what was so interesting, because do we see him again after that? I don't remember if we see him again after that. I think that
we
was
do.
The last...
No. He comes in a few more times, because once again, me using my English, like, A-level, he comes in a number of times later, but, like, we see, like, the relationship between them, like, not disintegrate, but, like, it gets worse and worse as time goes on. And again, like, this is why I think it's a really great book about boundaries, because eventually she realizes that, again, there's literally a quote I have at the bottom here where he's, like, smiling and trying to flirt with her, even though he knows that she can't offer him anything anymore. And she just says to herself, like, I fed off that kind of smile that he gave me when I've been starving, and I thought that, like, his like meager bits of affection, I thought that those crumbs were a feast, I thought that tiny bit of affection was good enough for me to live on, but I deserve better. And
powerful shit, love it.
This is where I say I do love the feminist vibes that she gives off.
Yeah, I have to agree. Because I think it's because, so what happens after she arrives in Crete is that her and Daedalus form this sort of kinship very, very quickly. But her sister has sort of asked her to come and help birth the Minotaur, because if I understood it correctly, it was Daedalus's fault, because this great bull had come to the island, and then they had sort of made a kinship, her sister and the bull, and then by somehow they had conceived a child, and it was Daedalus's fault, and now she had said Minotaur inside of her, and her sister was the only one that she could call upon to come and help give birth, because she was giving birth for a couple of days and they couldn't reach it. So when you're reading this birthing scene, it is quite graphic. It kind of scares you away from giving birth because it was quite intense at times, because it's like eating off of her arm. It's like flesh ripping because it's so hungry. It was very strange. When I read this, I was like, where are we going with this bull thing?
It was quite grim. Like,
it was grim.
But also, like, I don't fully understand why she was the only one that she could call on. Like, I think Daedalus at one point says, like, if you didn't come, it would have been me. And all literally all he did was, like, build her a hide so she could get closer to this ball. So it wasn't really his fault, but she, like, just twisted it around and made it his problem.
Yeah, I think that was ridiculous. I think the reason why she chooses Cersei, I think it's more like the two brothers would have kind of tried to find a way to, like, make this, like, make themselves more powerful, being like, oh, well, look, I helped you with this amazing thing. Or she's like, Cersei, you and I are so similar, but also you are nothing and you have nothing to lose. So, and it was, because they have a full conversation about it, and it was a full kind of, like, backhand, like, conversation, because she was, you know, Pasiphae was like trying to relate to Cersei and also be like, but you're literally nothing. I definitely agree that the birth scene was really graphic. It made me so uncomfortable. Also, the thought of how she had, like, how the baby was created terrified me. It was all a lot to read within a certain number of pages.
Yeah, that one I think we could have skipped, to be fair. Like, but what was so interesting in that scene, actually, because she asks her, like, hey, why did you call me? You have this brother that you were obsessed with as a child. You had our other brother. You are so popular amongst people. Why me? You can't stand me. You took the piss out of me my whole life. Like, why me? And what I thought was so interesting is that she got so vulnerable telling her why, that when she brought up her brother, she was like, you don't understand what he has done. I just thought, I was like, oh, what has he done? Like, did he rape you? Did he torment you? What has gone on behind closed doors that we just couldn't feel? Because I thought it was the worst of the worst in the mannerisms that she was talking about. Like, I got super analytical there. Like, what really happened here? Why her? Like, I agreed, but then you can really feel like she was the only one that she could count on.
Oh, no, I definitely agree. Like, in the way that part of the conversation went, your mind really does go to the worst. And the way she was saying, like, you don't know what I had to do to keep him, like to make sure that he wasn't gonna like do anything to anyone. And it's like, it's that awful, like your mind goes to that terrible place. And I think that's almost why she tries to, like, even though she doesn't think that Cersei is anywhere near her level, she does not see them as equals, but I think she's trying to reach a kind of common bond there. I mean, I don't think it works because they have two vitally different situations, but I think there is that kind of common trauma from their childhood that I think she's trying to be like, look, we're not the same, but we can at least understand we've come from similar areas of trauma. Let's bond over that. And Cersei's like, no, because you were part of that trauma that I have. So let's maybe not do this.
Oh, yeah. And I think that really united them. And then I think it was also closure at the same time, because from this, you know, she's then sent away. She's helped the Minotaur arrive, and she also tries to help her niece, who I really liked. I can't remember the name on top of the additional 100 characters in this book, but
her
really
name is
like
Ariadne.
There we go. I really like that character. I thought, you know, this is a woman that can stir up some shit and probably get stuff done.
I also really like that Daedalus said, like, carved Ariadne's like figure into like the front of all the ships, like of Ariadne dancing. I think that was what it was. And like when Cersei meets her, she's like dancing around the courtyard, and it's something so magical and precious about it. And like, she's so young and innocent. Like, when the Minotaur is born, like, Ariadne's just trying to understand and be like, everyone's calling him a monster, but like, he's still my brother. And I think Cersei is eventually like banned from seeing Ariadne, but I think Cersei's almost quite like touched to see that this young child who is like still one, almost like she can kind of relate, like, from her own childhood, like, Ariadne is just trying to make a connection with this brother. Like, she wants to make sure that she can like care for him and make sure that people don't run away at the sight of what everyone would assume is a monster. And she wants to build on that. And I thought that was quite a little sweet thing. And then internally, Cersei's going like, this girl's going to be absolutely betrayed in her life. And it was quite sad.
For sure. You can hear like her positive. It's kind of like Cersei's own journey, but in a younger form. Like, she's going to get hurt. She's going to get betrayed. All of these things. And also, I think, you know, watching Dandelos with his son, because they have this one scene where he's making her the loom and just creates such magnificent art, because she's then sent away by, like, she's then sent away from Crete to go back to exile because she's helped the Minotaur. Because he put her, the Minotaur, he created a maze under the labyrinth that for every moon, because for 3 harvests, he has a spell that Cersei created that he can control the hunger. Then on the other one, it will take like, I think 11 to 13 people that he needs to be fed to like help his hunger. And I just thought, you know, she's helped her, like this is her time. They probably won't see each other again, but it didn't feel sad. Like it felt like they got enough love out of each other that could last a lifetime. Like she always looked for him. She always felt him. And he created one of the most like beautiful pieces of furniture or art for her that everyone admired. So I really liked that scene. And then when she was going home, I was like, but you have a part of him with you for your eternity since yours is so long.
I also really liked, obviously she was let out of exile to come and like birth the baby, but I really appreciated that she was kind of allowed free reign almost, because like there's a point where she like marches up a mountain to like get the ingredients for this spell, and she's like able to like pick herbs and stuff and like take them with her. And then I just really like that once again she had the control and the power to then, with Deidalus, whatever his name is, she then kind of like chooses him to be like, while I'm here, I choose you to like hang out with and be my friend and like to be my confidant. And I thought it was all really nice that she had like physically the freedom to kind of like walk a little bit further and like see something different for once, but to also like have the choice of like having a friend and like who she can talk to and what she can say. And I think that was so lovely.
Yeah, I would agree so as well. And then if we sort of pick it up, otherwise we're going to sit here and talk about the plot for like the next 3 hours because it was so dense. But I think obviously she goes back to her island, and then she has people who are also exiled to her island. Like their fathers send her the most annoying bunch of girls. Like sometimes it's 7, sometimes it's 8. It starts with 1 and she's like, yeah, my father has exiled me here for a year and I must stay. And she's like, but why? I want to be alone. I just want to, you know, do my own thing. And she misses that. And they become an integral part of the story, because then sort of pirate sailors start coming to her island. Some of them start fearing her, but some of them also start to see what benefits it is. She's, you know, this alone woman. Well, she's with other people, but they don't know that. And then they go into her house, they see the gold, the treasures and everything, and then they take advantage. And I think the one sailor that had come, and obviously we read that rapes her, I think that was so tragic, because she had already gone through so much, and she was like, he was so much stronger, but it was like, oh, but I'm a god, I should be stronger. And I really felt for her in that scene. It was really heartbreaking.
It was such an upsetting one to read. And it's the point of like, she's like gone out of her way to like feed them all and like do all that. And she'd been, and like there's a point where we see, like we read that she like put herbs or something like in the wine that she was serving to them all. And she was gonna like say a spell to put them to sleep, but she didn't get the chance because like physically the guy was stronger and caught her off guard. And then we have to, like, that whole thing made me upset to read, because as you said, like she's been through so much and it was just awful. But then this is why I love the kind of revenge plotline she goes after, because she's then like, whenever sailors appear, she's like, I'm gonna get some great revenge. And it's, I think it was a very almost therapeutic way of her dealing with what happened, although we don't probably read about how she kind of processes that trauma. She just gets revenge on this, like on any soldier, because she doesn't know if they're good or bad. So as a safety blanket, she kind of curses them all, which I can kind of understand.
But when they first like arrive on the island, she's like so happy to see them. She's like thinking about how she can, like, she's going to offer them food and like a place to stay. And then like the second they realize she's there by herself, like all of their attitudes like turn almost immediately. And like the contrast between like how happy she is when she first sees them and that moment is like, it like broke my heart a little bit. I also think something like, there's like a running theme that's quite interesting to me. Like almost every time she sees, like not almost every time, like it's a couple of times she sees like someone coming onto the island, she's like in her like inner monologue, she thinks, oh, here's something that I can fix. And I think it's really interesting that like she is drawn towards these people that she feels like she can fix or she can help.
Also, I love the point you make that it's when the sailors realize that she's alone, because it's always that point of, and almost again, her being validated by men, the fact that the kind of like captain or like main pirate will be like, oh, you know, thanks, who do we give thanks to for this wonderful food and shelter, you know, is your husband, your father, your son, your uncle, is there any male presence around? So first of all, they're not going to thank her for what she's done, like, because she's the one that's welcomed them and taken care of them. But it's also that safety blanket of them going, okay, there's no one here to stop us from committing these atrocities. And again, it's that, it just, that part made me angry. And it happens multiple times. It's just men looking for, yeah, okay, will another man yell at us? No, let's, because they didn't see women as equal. And obviously at this point, I don't think they know that she's a goddess. They just see her as a vulnerable woman. And it's upsetting.
Yeah, which enrages me. At a later point in the book, I was like, oh, that's kind of intense and a little bit over the top, because they even ask her like, where is your father? Where is your husband? Where is your brother? An uncle? A master? Where is any male of the house? And then they like, they can see there's no hunting equipment and all of these things. And I was like, because she's a goddess, you know, this is possible. And like in your universe, I was so surprised when I read that. I was like, oh, so frustrating. Because after all of these negative experiences, we're then introduced to the character of Odysseus. Right?
I was saying Odysseus.
Yeah, Odysseus, yeah. So his character comes and she's like, oh, he's very different, he's well-spoken, you know. We learn that he's not always well-spoken and has a little bit of a temper, but he's someone that she is very intrigued by. And what she normally does is when they do come and they do violate her, she turns them into something, and most times she feeds them to like her pigs, or she does something with them, or makes them go to sleep, or transform into a creature. And I think with this one we saw a different side, because then she really takes care of his crew and lets them fix the ships, and then they stay for a winter, and you see this really sort of soft and sort of intimate relationship happen between them that is also a little bit strange, because he talks of his wife Penelope, and you know, no one really understands what she's thinking, but when she thinks it, she gets it done. She's, you know, a very formidable woman, and she births the son that we spoke about earlier, Telemachus, and everything about him, you know, that he cried and then he whispered to him, you know, be calm now, and then he never cried again. So I just thought it was quite a nice change that finally, after all of that trauma, she finally got someone who was a bit softer, maybe not as soft as we thought in the beginning, but still softer.
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting, like, again, going back to like the kind of like the, actually I don't know if at this point it's like her searching for that validation and wanting to be, I think it's that wanting to show that she's not looking for love almost, but like when Odysseus arrives, she's already turned all of his crew into pigs, and like he's fully aware, and she knows that he can't be turned, like she can't do anything to him because he's got moss something, and it's Hermes,
yeah.
Like Odysseus was the one that the prophecy was about, and Hermes had like given him this thing so that Circe wouldn't be able to curse him. And again, it's that showing that at this point Circe and Hermes, no, not friends, hate each other. Or they don't hate each other, but they're nothing to each other anymore. And I don't know if it's like, I don't know if that was meant to be taken as a good sign that Odysseus was given that thing to protect him from any spells. I didn't know if it was good or bad. I definitely didn't know whether I could trust him at the beginning, but it is that thing where I think she was quite vulnerable making his like crew human, even though they tried to attack her. I think it was a really good sign of goodwill, but I was really scared that she'd made a mistake at that point.
Yeah, same. I also think, like, as we continue, like, you could see he had a lot more wits. I also suspected something, because we do later learn that he had a relationship with Athena, the goddess of war, I believe. And what I could feel that there was something there, because he seemed a little bit too with it at times. Like, there was definitely something more to him. I don't know if you guys also got that vibe. It just feels like he knew way, way much more than just the fact that he had to have that herb with him.
Yeah. There was definitely something off. And like the thing that I did like about like over his time there with Cersei, I think he understood that she couldn't leave the island. So he told her every single story. So he updated her on all the things she missed, like what had happened with her sister, what was happening in the war with Troy. Because she, at this point, like, she didn't even know that Troy had gone to war, which obviously is someone who's read, like, I've read The Song of Achilles. So I kind of liked that Madeline Miller made a little nod to like the whole Achilles thing. That was just, I think, me being nerdy and enjoying that. But I think that was quite nice, the fact that he was willing to kind of like tell her everything about the world. And then she quite stayed on her guard, I think. Like, she didn't really, she told him like some stories, but she didn't tell like the deepest, darkest, most personal ones. And I thought, again, it was a great boundary setting moment, because she was very much like, I've been betrayed before, I'm not gonna fully go into this. Yeah, I like that bit.
Yeah, because then sometime later, obviously, he's like, I have to return to my island. I have to, you know, return to my wife and to my son. And because his island is Ithaca, and it's not super far from where they are, but it's still quite the journey. And she receives, you know, he says to her, you know, goddess, I have to return. And she's like, okay. And she receives a prophecy saying, you know, how he should get home, that he will make it home, but he has to do certain things. And then we later find out that he did take a pit stop for some years while doing that. And while he leaves, we learn that she becomes pregnant and births a son after Odysseus and names him Telegonus. And I just thought, you know, like, finally she'll have, when I read that she was pregnant, I was like, finally she'll have that family she was searching for. Maybe it's not the perfect family, but then it'll be some kind of family, right? But then maybe not, as we learn through the story.
Yeah, I think I was really holding out hopes of the baby. I was like, yes, someone, company, that's not an animal. And then I also found it really interesting that her baby's name is really similar to Odysseus's other son's name. But it also was like really confusing when like you're reading about the two of them and you're just like, wait, who's who? Which one's which? And that was the only thing that kind of got me quite confused.
I like find it really funny that, I mean, not funny, but like basically this child is like screaming constantly, like it hates the world. It doesn't want to be there, doesn't want to be held, doesn't want to be put down. And she's the whole time, she's like, I'm trying her best, bless her, she's trying to figure out what's going on. And when she talks about it later, everyone's like, well, you're difficult, you make everything difficult. Why do you think your child's going to be any different than you? And I'm like, I mean, at no point does she make life difficult for anyone. Like, she's literally on an island by herself. But, like, everyone is constantly telling her, like, it's like a mirror image of you. You make life difficult, therefore you had a difficult child. And I, like, felt sorry for her when people were telling her that. But in her head, she, like, kind of just accepts it, which I think is a little bit weird.
Sounds like gaslighting to me.
I was just going to say, for sure, because then when, you know, she has the son, what I thought was so insightful, she's so aware. She is so self-aware and then also just so observant, because she would see like pots falling and things falling all over the place and just these random things happening. And then all of a sudden she noticed that it must be the work of one of the other gods. And then she finds out that Athena has tried to threaten her and kill her son. But she then works, you know, to cast a spell over the island and banish her from it. And she's like trying to do this spell, but the sun will not let her work or anything like that. I'm like, poor girl, like she can't catch a fucking break at any moment.
Literally. But I thought this is just such a really powerful moment for her. The fact that she's had absolutely no training. No one has guided her at all. She's like, everything she knows of witchcraft, she's learned herself. And the fact that she just on instinct can make this spell that will cover the whole island to keep her and her son safe from a literal god. I just think that's one of the most bad bitch moves she could have possibly made. And all the while having this child that she's screaming in her face, it was just phenomenal. But it's kind of saddening later on, because obviously she has to keep like redoing this spell to keep it like on hold. And it's like the point where you can really see that this is the one thing that she does struggle with slightly alone. I mean, she's a great mum at this point, far better than her own parents. But there's a point where her son is like screaming, and she tries to give him like a spell. And I can't remember what happens, but like he falls and gets injured. And she's not, at first, I think she goes like, was that Athena? Was that me? Like, who hurt my child? I think she has that really scary moment where she realized, like, I can't believe I stooped that low. I nearly force my child to sleep. Like, I can do this myself. I need to get back to like an actual spell, like the one keeping us all safe. And it's the fact that when she describes that big spell protecting the island, she feels like it's always like a weight on her back. Like, she's always carrying this power around, which I thought was amazing, but also like I felt exhausted on her behalf.
Yeah. And then of course then she helps raise him, and he, as he grows older, he starts to speak and is a little bit more interactive with her, but it's never that tactile. It's not the most, you know, affectionate relationship, which is, I think, is what she was really hoping for this whole time. And I also think that he obviously wants to become his own person, because as he grows older, I think when he becomes, you know, 16, as we see, he asks, okay, I want to have this space for myself. I want to do these things on my own. I want to have all of these things to myself, as she did with her brother, as we saw when she was growing up. So I sort of really related to that. I mean, it's just the two of them. They didn't really do much together. It does take two people, I think, to make a family. So when he started doing that, I was like, oh, that kind of makes sense. And then we get to learn that he was visited by another god, and he's trying to build this boat so he can go to Ithaca to visit his dad and be with his dad for a winter. But I think all the while, you know, poor girl cannot catch a break. She wanted a son. Now, as soon as he can, he wants to leave her and go live his own life, because fair play, of course, fair enough, but it's still not the most tactile relationship. And I feel like she's just yearning for that kinship, whatever form it is. Because during this course, we also see that the lion that she had raised also passed away. And she was so hurt by that as well.
Mm. Yeah, I know, for sure. I also love the fact that the god that's appeared to like talk to her son is Hermes. And he's shit stirring, I think, in the worst way. Because I think at this point, he's fully aware of how important her like son is. And he knows that he's not happy. And so he's shit stirring and being like, oh, you should definitely leave the island. Oh, let me teach you some things. And it's kind of like making the prospect of the outside world so much better. And I think that Hermes does a lot of bad things, but I think that is one of the worst backstabs he could have done, because he's very much like trying to take that one piece of comfort that she has and just take it away from her.
Yeah, I completely agree, because then when we're seeing this, while he's saying, you know, I want to go, she like forbids him and says, you won't, and then sort of comes together and is like, you know, he needs to live a life. So then she sort of does everything for him, and she goes to see the great sea monster so she can get the venom from his tail and put it on a spear, which she knowingly does, and then makes like sort of this, well, one, she breaks her exile to go and do it, but then she also like says, you know, I'll do something in return for protection, gets the sort of venom and then puts it on the spear and, you know, instructs him what to do and how to get there. And I just thought, you know, still after someone being kind of cruel to her and everything, she still just wants what's best. So then when she sets him off and everything like that, she really does try and help him in the most practical way to really protect him, because she puts the spell that can't sink the ship, even though we later learn that this boat is genuinely terrible and should have sunk ages ago.
When I was reading the part where she goes down to get like the towel from that god, I don't know why, I think I must have skipped some lines, but in my head I was picturing a mermaid and not like a god of, what was it, stingrays? And I was like, how is she going to use that towel to make us, like, what was it, like a spear type thing? I was like, I'm very confused. It took me like a solid chapter to figure out that it was a stingray and not a mermaid. So yeah, I did well there.
I didn't even realize that. I imagined it in the most childish way possible as just like a massive eel, but specifically one of the animated eels from like The Little Mermaid. I don't know why that's where my head went to, but that's all I could see.
Yeah, and I would completely agree. I also pictured like the most childish thing in him like sticking out like the end of the tail and just being like, take the venom. So yeah, that one was a little bit strange. But then he obviously goes off Telegonus, and he goes to the island to find his dad. And I thought it was so rushed, because she sets the pace of the book kind of slow, and I felt like she had skipped such a at length, like she just jumps to the fact that he comes back and is telling her what happened and that his dad had touched the spear, which you can't do as a mortal because it kills you, and he touched it because he wouldn't believe him. And I was like, How did I skip something? Because this felt so rushed. I'm not sure if we felt the same, but I was just like, oh, and he's back.
I completely agree. Like, the middle of the book where she's by herself drags on forever, and like nothing really happens. It's just her like coming into like her powers and stuff and figuring out all of these herbs. And then the space between him leaving and him coming back happens so quickly. It's like a matter of a page and a bit. And it just felt like it didn't match the rest of the pace of the book.
I definitely agree. Like, it happened so quickly. But the one bit I do like is when he's like kind of telling the story about what happened with his dad. Like, his dad's like a completely different person. But like, he like, when his dad's like lying there dying, he like does it to like say, like, look, I'm your son. I like that little section. But like, it kind of like came so quickly. I couldn't even be sad for like what Telegonius had gone through, because I was like, it's happened so quickly. I can't even think about it.
I completely agree. And then we continue on. Then he like just randomly announces, oh, and they're with me, you know, the son of Odysseus, Telegonus. I'm going to get his name wrong every single time. Telegonus, and this one is so close. And then also Penelope is with him. And then she's like, but why? Why are they here? And then they obviously start one of the most strange sort of ex-wife or current wife and mistress relationships we've ever seen. But I thought it was quite nice, because then you finally see sort of Telegonus finally have this family that he's always wanted. He learns how to swim. The other brother, you know, helps around the island and fixes things. And then when Penelope can, you know, handle it after all of her grief of losing her island, her home, and her husband, she's like looming and she's doing all of these things, and then eventually becomes a witch herself. But I think it was quite a nice conclusion. It just did feel a little bit rushed after all of the pace and slowness of the book.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. But like the bit with the ending that like just takes that kind of like, I kind of saw it coming, but it still just made me upset, is the whole kind of like Athena plotline. Like, Athena really was out for blood for this whole damn book. And it's just sad, man.
Yeah, because they also rushed that. Then we find out Odysseus and Athena are linked, of course. And then she sends the messenger and is like, Athena wants to talk to Telemachus and, you know, have this sort of great discussion. And then obviously Circe's like, you need to give us 3 days, but she can obviously lift the spell of the island to let her in at a moment's notice, but it's just to give Penelope and Telemachus time to speak and to get through their issues, because they haven't spoken since they arrived at the island. And I just thought, you know, this is a shit show of immense proportion, because then she shows up and then she makes this grand offering and is like, come with me, I will make you this renowned and legacied king and prophet who will take over lands and own these great hills of olives and etc. etc. And I just thought, where was this pace throughout the rest of the book? Because so much is happening. And then obviously Telemachus says no and is like, I just want to live a simple life. I don't want to be renowned. I just want to live a very simple life. And his mom is like, yo, I can't convince him. So she offers it to Telegonus and he's like, don't ask me twice. The ship's coming this afternoon. I'm out. Please, mom, don't be mad.
Like, it's almost really funny how fast.
Sorry. He like really just doesn't think about it for a second. He's like, there. He like decides in a matter of seconds. I'm kind of mad about it. Like, I feel bad for Circe. She's finally got like, as weird as this like family situation is, like, it's there now and she's not alone, and it's kind of like the what she's been looking for. And immediately her son is just like, decides to go like win some wars or whatever he's chosen to do. But like, I just like, I felt bad for her, and I understand that it's in his nature, it's what he wants to do, which is absolutely fine, but I just felt really bad for her in that situation.
And it's like sad because I think at this point as well, like, Telegonius and Circe are in like a relatively good place, like, and she's like realizing, even though, like, as a child, he seems completely disinterested, he's, like, able to name all the herbs in the garden and all their properties. And it's like she's kind of realizing, oh, he did actually listen. He did actually care. He just didn't know how to, like, share that and communicate those feelings. So it's that thing of, like, she finally feels like she's got this relationship with her son. And then the first chance she gets, he like leaves with the god that was literally the other year planning to murder him as a child. And it's just that it was upsetting, and I did feel really sorry for her.
Yeah, I completely agree, because then obviously in the afternoon they come and get her, well, him, and he sets sail for the great lands, and she, you know, takes a little bit of time, she goes inward, she doesn't really speak to anyone, and then she's like, you know what, if this, I've had enough. I want to go live a life. I've given everything to everyone. It's now my time. She set the boundary. And then I finally feel like we've come full circle, because then she's like, Helios, I summon thee. Come at me. Like, let's discuss this. And I love that scene, actually. It was like the one scene I was like, yes, finally, woman, like, get you some. Because then she demands her freedom. She wants out of exile. She's like, please just set me free. I have done this with Prometheus, you know, I helped him, and I don't think Zeus would like the fact, because you know what was so interesting throughout the book, and I think I mentioned this earlier, is his four children were something to Zeus be scared, and it was the four children he couldn't give less of a shit about. Like, it was the four that could have made a difference, where he could have, you know, made all of these plottings that she brings up, you know, I've heard all of your plottings, I've heard of your treachery and all of these things. And she used that in her complete favor. He is super scared of me, and you've talked about treachery, and I can ruin your whole thing. I'll either tell him that, or let me be, and don't ever consider me your child ever again. And she seemed fully at peace. It wasn't like, oh, I'm super sad about myself. No, no. I want to live a life for me.
I just loved that. You can just see, like, she's learned so much over the course of the book, and she's just gained that confidence in herself that she could perfectly confidently go to a, like, to a full god and just be like, I want nothing, like, free me, and then don't call me a kid. I don't want anything to do with you. I'm going to live life in a way that you don't have to be ashamed of, because I won't be your child. So leave me alone. Let me go. And I just thought it was great. It was the ultimate kind of, like, kick-ass moment, I think. Just absolutely, like, yelling at her dad, who obviously is like caused, like, he was the kind of, like, first problem in her life, and I think seeing her stand up to that, to the man that was so cruel, was just amazing.
I love, like, the moment where she turns around and she's like, don't worry, you don't need to even count me as one of your children. Sorry, it's just started chucking it down, and I'm really sorry if you can hear it, but, like, it's just like, in, like, practice, she was never really like his child anyway. He didn't do anything to help raise her, so her turning around and saying, like, don't even count me as one of your children, like, it really doesn't matter to her in any way, shape, or form. Like, only on paper has he been her dad, and I think that's, like, the moment that becomes really clear.
I completely agree, and you feel like she's gotten it, really, like, motivated a lot of things throughout that, the rest of the scene, because then she goes off, you know, and she's like, I'm leaving tomorrow at dawn. If you want to join, you want to stay, up to you. And then obviously Penelope's like, no, I think I'll stay. I have no reason to go back to Sparta. And really, you can really feel now, like, this is now the life she's going to live for herself, no one else. And then you finally get to see, because Telemachus is like, no, I'm going to come with you. And she's like, yeah, but it's going to be hard. There's going to be scary or frightful things. It could even cause or lead to your death. And he's like, yeah, but you know that I want to come with you. I haven't spoken to you. You were upset, and you can feel this, like, sexual tension between them. And then they set out on their own journey, and they go through, you know, Scylla and everything. But what did you guys think about them? Because I was like, I kind of knew that was going to happen. You could feel this, like, sexual tension between them, even though it is a bit weird.
Oh, I was like, you could just definitely tell.
Said at the exact same time.
No, you could definitely feel that it was coming. And, like, it's just that it's like Maddie said earlier, like, if you have to, like, question whether or not it's incest, it probably is. Like, if you think of the reasoning, like, for Telemachus, whatever, Circe is his dad's mistress, or, like, his brother's mum. I don't, it just doesn't sit right. But like the way that they're written, you really root for them, and you kind of like, you know, Cersei imagines the whole life that they're going to lead, and you know, he sounds amazing, and then I'm just reminded of the fact that like, but like she's kind of like his stepmom, so it just weirded me out a little bit. But I liked the way that they were written, minus the incest, if that makes any sense.
I mean, yeah. In the whole grand scheme of like Greek gods, it's really not that bad, but it's still weird to read about it. And I mean, like, again, technically there's nothing there, but like, you shouldn't have to say the word technically in order to make it okay. Like, it is a little bit weird. And the whole time I was like, I like Beth said, I like the way it's written, but I just couldn't get out of my head that like, in theory, like, he's your step kid. Like, that's, it's kind of like weird.
Yeah, I agree. I thought that was hella weird. But then obviously they go off and they do all of these tales and such, and then they meet Skala, and then they turn her to stone, and they go to all of these different islands and have travel, and Penelope becomes this witch and such. But I do think it was weird, but I really enjoyed the ending, because as I said before, it is a very slow burn. But, and I can see who could enjoy it. So I think, you know, to round this all off, like, obviously if we go one by one on the critique of the book, but I think just from my side, my critique, definitely think that Song of Achilles, her other book, was way, way, way better. But I also think I can see who would enjoy this. And I do like the writing, but it is not a book, in my opinion. It's like a set of five tales, and it has a nice ending, at least. I really think she deserved the good ending. And if I would have taken something away, I would have taken out The Birth of the Bull. To be honest, I would have taken out that, because I didn't really understand what his purpose was.
I liked the book. I definitely agree that I think I prefer Song of Achilles. Like, the writing, like, Song of Achilles is a little bit of a slow burn, but it, like, it doesn't happen over the course of like hundreds of years. Like, that one is within the space of like 10. And like, it's, you know, that one, I like the progression. This one, like, it could have definitely been made shorter. We didn't talk about it, but rightfully so, because it doesn't massively impact the plot. But like, there's a whole plot line where she's visited by like Medea and Jason. That bit made no sense to me, and I don't think it needed to be in the plot. Like, it had no point being there, and like, it could have really easily been removed, and it wouldn't have changed, like, it would have made the book quicker, and it would have made it a little bit less complicated. But like, I did like it in the end. Like, I did like the book, so I don't, yeah.
Look, this book's just not for me. I don't want to like hate on it, because I know like it's written for a specific type of person, and I'm just not that. Like, Beth knows, but my worst reading habit is that I only read the dialogue, and when the dialogue only happens like every six pages, it's like, it's a struggle to get through for me. But like, I'm happy she got her happy ending, and I'm glad I read it. Like, it was interesting, but to me it read like a book I would have to read at school. Like, it isn't one that I would just go and pick up and read for enjoyment. Like, it was kind of a struggle to get through.
100%, definitely a struggle. But having said that, thank you so much to everyone for listening to this week's episode of the Everything With Vile podcast, bonus episode of the first fiction book review. Please, please go and subscribe and listen to the Off the Book podcast. They release a new episode every week. I will leave it to them to sort of plug what they're doing, but they're amazing, so please give them some love.
Thank you so much. Well, fun fact, for this month, we're actually doing two episodes a week in an absolute plot twist. I know. Does it mean lots more work? Yes, it does. That is why we are reading. We are literally reading like 1,000 pages over the next like 2 days, because we have a lot of books to read. But I think the best person to do our social media and plug everything is Maddie, because I'm forgetful and she knows everything.
Yeah, so we're Off the Book the podcast. If you just search on whatever like podcast
thing you're listening on, you'll find us on TikTok and Instagram. We're at @offthebook_thepodcast. Our Twitter is @offthebook_pod, and we've got like a Gmail and stuff, but they're all like linked in our bios if you're interested in that. But yeah, thank you for having us on. It's been fun.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for joining once again. And to everyone, thanks again. Please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And until next time, have a great week. Stay safe. And thank you so much, Beth and Maddie. Bye-bye.